Hi, it's Anne Strainchamps with To the Best of Our Knowledge, and today we're going to talk about the future of hip-hop. And to get to the future, we're going to start with the past.
I had made it home with my siblings, and we were at the door to our apartment building, and a shootout broke out. And it was quite an intense moment. I'm the oldest sibling, and I had all this responsibility for my younger siblings, but in the midst of, you know, the gunshots, I just froze. And luckily, we were all safe. And after the sort of shots had died down, we made it into our apartment building. We made it up to our apartment. And my younger sister was telling my mother what happened. And as she described what happened, she described the fact that I had just frozen standing up right there in that moment. And my mom said, you know, you can't ever afford to do that. If a situation like that ever happens, you know, you have to get on the floor right away and ensure that you don't get shot. A little while later, a couple weeks later, I believe, you know, I was in school. And I vividly remember this moment. I can smell the classroom, like the old wood in the classroom. I can see the teacher at the front of the class, and he's teaching a math lesson, and it wasn't the most engaging lesson, and the class is like sort of like half there and half not. As we're sitting there, and as he's teaching his lesson, and all you hear is him talking and the scratches of chalk against the blackboard, I hear this loud boom in the hallway. And, you know, almost immediately, I jumped under my desk to the floor and sort of cowered under there. And I quickly realized that, no, this was not the gunshot experience, right? And it happened to have been just a door that shut in the hallway. My teacher then walked towards me to my desk and sort of reprimanded me. I look back up. My friends are all laughing. And in that moment, I probably wanted to tell him, it's because I was scared. I went through something a couple of weeks back, but there was no space to do that. And as he sort of yelled at me and punished me and sent me to the principal's office, I sort of smirked and walked up and sort of walked out of the classroom. And none of us were the wiser.
This is Chris Emden, and this is not just his story he's telling. There are thousands of kids like Chris in urban schools all over America. And the thing to notice is that there are two kinds of trauma in this story. The first is experiencing a gunfight right outside your front door. And the second, maybe the bigger one, is feeling invisible because your experience is unrecognized in the place you spend 8 hours a day, the classroom.
It's really the deeper soul wound when you're in a place where you can't be yourself. You can't speak certain ways. You can't act certain ways. You can't talk about certain things. And so when your whole being is policed, you know, your physical being is policed, your soul is policed, your culture is policed, you sort of have to second guess everything. And so you don't have the opportunity to be free enough to learn.
Chris Emden has dedicated his life to giving inner city kids that freedom. At Columbia University, he teaches teachers, and you can get a sense of his lesson plan in his book called For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. Lesson number one, hip-hop.
You see, we're talking about young people who traditionally underperform in schools, who are not engaged in the teaching and learning process, who are sort of least likely to answer questions or ask questions. They enter into schools where they are very, very passive. And schools oftentimes work towards getting them to be more engaged and sometimes say, I don't understand why these young people aren't engaged or why they aren't motivated or why they're so apathetic once they're in school. But the reality is that the same people who are apathetic and disengaged in school outside of school, engage in a number of practices where they express the type of brilliance that schools claim that they want. So if I go into a hip-hop cipher, for example, there is engagement, there is laughter, there is joy, there is celebration, there is a memorization of information rather quickly, there is the opportunity to be able to sort of work together with someone else to show them that they care and that they're valued. And so what we sometimes demonize young people for lacking in school actually becomes expressed in spaces outside of school. And so the argument becomes, rather than demonize young people for not expressing those forms of brilliance in school, how can we transform the culture of school to allow the forms of brilliance that exist outside of school to be welcome in the classroom? You know, it requires a shift in how teachers teach. You know, maybe your class is not supposed to be completely quiet. You know, maybe a young person doesn't have to walk in the hallway with their shoulder against the wall like I saw in a school last week. You know, maybe the metal detectors at the door and the bars on the window make them feel as though you think of them as criminals, and because you think of them as such, they enact behaviors that align to that kind of behavior. And so how do we create new models to allow the brilliance that is expressed outside of school to be expressed in school so we can then connect that to content?
Well, you've been working. Your work is about finding new ways, really a whole new way of teaching, and changing the culture of the classroom and the relationships that can exist between teachers and students. But one way, really specifically, that you've pioneered is bringing hip-hop into classrooms. So let's talk a little bit about that just as a kind of case in point. You've got a lot of experience teaching science using hip-hop, for instance. How does that work?
You know, it works rather magically, actually, right? You know, what we simply do is, or what I've done in my Science Genius project, for example, is walk into schools and sort of ask young people if they'd be willing to showcase what they've learned in class through hip-hop. And believe it or not, the initial response is, no, this is not what hip-hop is about. Hip-hop is about money, and it's about cash, and it's about this, and it's about that. It's not supposed to be about science. How could you expect us to use hip-hop to connect to science? And then I always say, oh, so that means you're not really that great of a hip-hop artist, because if you were, you'd be able to rap about anything. And I think that that kind of competition and that charge is part and parcel of hip-hop.
You also brought GZA from Wu-Tang Clan.
Well, you know, that helps a little bit, right? Bringing in GZA from Wu-Tang helps a little bit, and bringing Kendrick Lamar to a classroom does not hurt. But beyond that, you know, just challenging them. And once you lay down that gauntlet and say, I challenge you to be able to sort of express your brilliance through this cultural artifact, young people do it. So in Science Genius, you know, we have young people across the country right now who write raps about science content. It can't be superficial. It has to be scientifically rigorous. You have to have, you know, true facts in it. It has to really connect to the content matter.
So they can't just drop in, they can't just drop in some rhymes with some science words.
Right. You know, DNA, we're here to play, won't work, you know. It has to be nuanced. It has to be complex. And a lot of people think that when you talk about hip hop or you talk about culture, it means that we're lowering expectations. Absolutely not. The expectations are the same, if not higher. You know, because we are using something that people are going to perceive as anti-academic, we are more focused on ensuring that the content is rigorous and it's rigid. But you could be rigorous and still fun. You know, rigor is not rigor mortis. A good classroom doesn't have to bore young people to death. And so they rap about the science content, and they're brilliant. And then we ask them to compete with each other. So a young person in Brooklyn will compete with a young person in the Bronx or in Toronto or in Calgary, Canada, you know, using hip-hop around science content. And at the end of the day, we crown, you know, a science genius, which is a person who is a brilliant scientist, but also has, you know, swag and presence and authenticity and artistry. It's this idea of moving from STEM to STEAM, but really making sure that that A in STEAM is not just art, but it's art and culture.
Explain to me the deeper kind of revolutionary power of hip-hop, because it's not just any music you're bringing in. There's something in particular about hip-hop as not just a musical form, a culture, a language, and an underlying philosophy. That's what you're really bringing into the classroom, right?
Absolutely. Sometimes when I enter into spaces and folks, you know, folks will ask me about my book, or they'll ask me about some previous work, and then they'll say, and now show us the hip-hop thing. They're asking for a performance. And while performance is part of hip-hop, it's such a thin slice of the complexity and the depth of the culture. And what we bring is the full culture. So what is it about hip-hop, right? That's the question, right? I think the thing about hip-hop is that it's a set of artifacts like music, like b-boying or graffiti or DJing, et cetera. Like it is those things. It is those elements. But hip-hop is also a set of sensibilities. It's a way of walking through the planet. It's the soundtrack to the lives of young people. There's something about the bottom of the boom that calls forth ancestors from beyond the United States. There's something about crafting words in rhyme that's not just about making them rhyme, but about making them sort of connect and speak truth. It's the way young people dress. It's the voice intonations. It's the way that there's sort of nonverbal language. When two young people from the hip-hop generation, you know, walk into a room with a whole bunch of folks who are not from where they're from, they can give each other one knowing head nod. And through that head nod alone, they have had a 5-minute or 10-minute conversation. Mm-hmm. It is the beauty of the non-script that we want to capture and bring into the classroom. And I think that can be done by sort of invoking the spirit of hip hop in the classroom. And what I mean by that is, you know, make the classroom have an instrumental and a backdrop, you know, create a space where young people can sort of write on the walls and express themselves, you know, allow the teachers to not just be the person who's leading the conversation, but who's a part of the dialogue, you know, structure the classroom like the hip hop cipher, where you have rappers positioned in circles, speaking to each other through head nods and synchrony and with arms around each other, with this sort of camaraderie among strangers. It's like bringing those structures to the classroom allows the energy of the classroom to shift and then opens up spaces for teaching and learning to happen on a level that we just could not even capture at all through the traditional model of teaching and learning.
And the thing that you're doing that has gotten locked out of the educational system, and you make this really compelling and really depressing analogy to the boarding schools that Native American children were sent off to, you know, back in the 1800s to try to denativize them.
Right. I mean, I open up the book with making connections between Native American populations or indigenous populations writ large and youth of color in urban spaces. And I make the argument that we can find such strong connections. But it's really because I find that, one, if you want to understand the process of extracting culture from young people and the implications it has on their learning, we can just look at what happened in those boarding schools. You know, the Carlisle School in the mid-1800s, where we had Native American populations brought to schools, and the instruction was to extract their culture from them. You know, don't dress that way. Don't look that way. We're going to make you American. We're going to make you better. Don't look or sound or feel or taste like anywhere that you come from. And if you can do that, if you can extract out all that makes you who you are, then you've gotten an education and you're prepared to take on the world. And, you know, that happened in the 1800s. It would never happen again. We can identify the kind of trauma that the indigenous populations underwent by going through that form of schooling. The same thing is happening today. Mm. And this is my mission. You know, I lose sleep at night over this. I wrote this book over this. We have to do something to allow educators to create spaces for young people to have their brilliance awakened, because I know it exists there. And how do I know? Because I lived it and I saw it and I experienced it. And we can do this differently.
Well, Chris, through your words, we can glimpse the new world. And thanks for helping build it.
Thank you for having me.
One, two, one, two. Check it, check it. World out, world out.
Chris Emden is the author of For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and The Rest of Y'all Too. He's a professor at the Teachers College at Columbia University. And you can hear some of those amazing science genius battles at our website at ttbook.org. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about the future of hip-hop, and I think I just saw it. There's this news show from Senegal. It's called Journal Rappé. It's delivered live from Senegal. The news anchor is this guy named Kuman. He looks like a black Anderson Cooper with dreadlocks. He's wearing a crisp black suit, shirt, tie. He's sitting at a news desk like a traditional news anchor. Video of the world news is playing behind him, okay. And then he opens his mouth.
Bonjour.
And if you own the beat,
bien Bienvenue, installez-vous, on a des nouvelles pour vous. Il y a des bonnes, il y a des mauvaises, mais il y a des nouvelles pour vous. Bienvenue, installez-vous, on a des nouvelles pour vous. Il y a des bonnes, il y a des mauvaises, mais il y a des nouvelles pour vous.
And forget the future of hip-hop. This sounds like the future of news. Kumon is rapping in French and Wolof, and it's about the week's news, economics, politics, the environment. Charles Monroe Kane sat down with Kumon in our studio in Madison recently, along with someone who is helping to bring performers like Kumon to international attention. Her name is Toni Blackman, and she's the former hip-hop ambassador to the U.S. State Department. Charles Monroe Kane was like, she was what?
You're representing our country as an ambassador. That's kind of incredible.
I'm telling you what, it blows my mind sometimes, because there I was in the Grand Hotel, and then they showed me where the Rumble in the Jungle was.
Right.
And I'm like, yo, this is like really history. Wow. You know, it's really history. And then to be around so many super talented artists who we didn't need to speak the language. We walked in the room vibing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel it in your bones. And I remember one night we hung out, we got to see this band, and the drums were made with like a tree trunk. It was some young cats. They plugged the keyboard into a building next door. And then it was a full band, three guys who were rapper singers who chat ragga style, and they danced. And I never heard any music like this. It was a combination of rumba, hip-hop, soukous, and they did it so well. Mm-hmm. And they went from rapping to singing to doing a dance move. And it was like one of those times in my life where I wish I wasn't an artist. I wished I was an agent.
So, Zuman, I have a question for you. Now, I would say I have been in hip-hop culture. I'm 48 years old, so kind of my whole life has been kind of permeated by that culture. And I thought I've seen a lot of things inside of hip-hop. What I've never seen is someone rap the news. Can you tell me about your Senegalese news program?
Okay, yes. So I started doing this radio program, and this radio program was about freestyling, about DJing, about like hip-hop. When I finished my radio program, I finished at 5, and at 5, the news started. But what was a bit disturbing is the fact that when I finished my radio program and when the news starts, it seems like the news and the information were not linked.
Sure, right.
So I was like, you know, I definitely got to find a way to, you know, to create the link between two of these things, because Chuck D used to say that hip-hop is the CNN of the streets.
Right.
In Senegal, we have like more than 5,000 groups of hip-hop. Groups, not rappers. So 5,000 groups of hip-hop, it represents a lot of people. A lot of rappers. It represents a lot of people listening to hip-hop. It represents a crowd, a big crowd. So we'd be like, okay, we're just going to be the medias from this crowd. We're going to be the missing links between the information and the entertainment. And we just like borrow Gyrus' one word in saying that we're just trying to be entertainers, mixing entertainment and education. So in a way, yeah, we can say that we just definitely wanted to change our culture.
Tony, I think for me, and I want to interrupt, because I think for listeners, I want to understand, like, you're quoting KRS-One, you're quoting Chuck D, you're talking about something from American culture. You're American, you're in that you're in that culture, and you've proselytized that in a sense abroad. How does that make you feel? I feel pretty proud when I hear it. How do you feel about that?
No, I think one of the most beautiful things that happened to me my first time in Senegal was that I was at the National School of the Art, and there were elders, like older elders, and they were in traditional garb, and they came up to me and they bowed their heads in their hands, and then someone started to translate, and one man almost had tears in his eyes. He was like, thank God you're here. And he said what they didn't know, that there were people of African descent, Black Americans, who gave any care.
Wow.
Because all they saw was the mainstream coming. And it was almost like they prayed over me so that I would stay focused and stay on the path. Like you need to stand the value of what your work is.
You have a word that you use, and you guys were using it together before we started recording here, a word that I now realize has great power. that I didn't really fully understand until a couple days ago, and that's the word cipher.
Yeah.
Can you define that word for me? And I want you both to talk about ciphering for me and what that means.
Well, the cipher is spelled C-Y-P-H-E-R. In the 90s, it was spelled C-I-P-H-E-R. The young people changed it, so we just decided to go along with that. The cipher represents 360 degrees. It's about completion of thought, giving and exchanging energy, information, and ideas. The cipher is zero and the sum of all things at the same time. The word came out of, according to Harry Allen, I confirmed this with Harry Allen, the media assassin from Public Enemy, and it's something I had always thought. There was a sect of Islam here in the U.S. called the Five Percenters. And many hip hoppers joined the 5% Nation in the early 90s, late 80s. They were seeking something that for them fed them something different than the church. Mm-hmm. The church was no longer speaking to sure. our generation. And so when they would go to study their lessons, there would be ciphers and there's different layers and uses of the word.
Now, Zuman, I have a question because in a sense, a lot of what she's talking about is that as a noun, but it's also a verb. How do you cipher as a verb?
In Wolof, in my native language, we have something that we call kurel. Kurel, that's a group of people, and this group of people exactly they just like have to create this circle, and exactly they like chanting from I don't know the whole night. And sometimes they chant so much that some of them get just like, they're in trance. Kurel, this kurel, or the cipher, as you're saying, it's have exactly the same power or the same energy as Tony was saying in the hip-hop. Mm. Yeah.
If I'm not vibing off of what Human just said, then we're not really having a cipher, right? That's something, that's a distinction that's often missed when we talk about many of the ciphers that are on TV or YouTube. But there has to be this connection. There has to be this sharing.
Does it have to be, is it spiritual? Is it always, I mean, does it get to that level?
Technically, it's not spiritual. It's just that we are human beings having a spiritual experience. So we're just identifying, we are identifying what is so
yes.
that is not obvious to most.
Right.
Yeah. So, right. yeah.
You know, I think about it in freestyling, for example, a thing that I find incredible because for people I know who are truly freestyling, they don't know what they're going to say next, right? And I think about that act, and I think that act has to include something bigger than themselves, correct? I mean, I don't think you can do that alone. You know what I mean? Like,
one of the reasons why I became an advocate for improvisation, particularly amongst rap artists, is because you have to connect to something bigger than to yourself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you don't recognize God or Allah, that's fine. Mm-hmm. However, it's not about you. But when you're improvising, you've got to let go. Mm. And if some moment you're going to surprise yourself about what comes out.
And in our country, in our culture, we have the griots. The griots, they are the storytellers. And the griots, they have the, like, they are MCs. Like, they come in a place. They don't even know you. Listen, they have, like, a kind of techniques that they're using. They don't even know the person who are around. But based on what they're saying, based on the way you, on your clothes, they're improvising a song, singing for you.
Nice.
Period.
I have a question for you, too, if you don't mind me asking. Your elders, you're from across different continents. My listeners out there are public radio listeners, mm-hmm. you know, hundreds of thousands of them listening to this right now. Can you perform for them a message that would maybe touch them in a way so they can understand this movement a little bit better?
Okay.
Is that, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but also at the same time, I feel like this is a moment where I think we need to hear it.
There we go. Who am I on the beat? Tony V. All the way. Fitting from the heart right now. So check this. As I be coming through with the public radio listener talking to you. So you can know as we say what we feel. The negative energy said we intend to kill. We understand how hip-hop builds. We understand how hip-hop heals. We understand how you might feel based upon the mainstream and the stories that they tell. What? but we have another side to this vision. We ask you to listen and to listen with precision. We making an incision inside of your heart. I said I improvise it right now so you could pause, so you can start right now, right here, and be clear right now, right here. I said I have no fear when I start to talk about this culture of mine. I said this hip-hop, it steadily blows my mind. I said for many, many years, I've been down, and for many, many years, I'ma stick around because I know what art can do to set us free, because I know the purpose of art and the poetry. What you got? Come on.
Me? What do I have?
Yeah,
I
don't have anything. Got? You have nothing? Come on.
Not me. I think that art, I believe that art can set us free. Because
yes.
I think it's the thing that created us.
Yes.
In the first place.
Creation.
And it's creation, right?
Yes. I think that creating, as you say, recreating, for me, it's something that defining us.
You know, I think that we have the capacity using the arts to make our world a better place. But I don't know. There's this idea that change, it makes people so uncomfortable, even though change is inevitable. Mm-hmm. And how often do we sit and talk about the future of hip hop? Most of the time, we're looking back at it, or we're critiquing what's wrong with it now. But we don't make time for that. It's like we're afraid to, you said believe in the art. We're afraid to believe. We're afraid to dream. We're afraid that we're going to be disappointed. We won't take those kinds of risks. And so we sit with the familiarity of what is causing us pain. I have so many young people who come to me after not being as young as they were and tell me that the cipher saved their life.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know, literally. That hip-hop saved their life, that poetry saved their life. It's not about you becoming this big-time successful rapper, but it's about you becoming a great human being who is living a full life and who has the confidence and courage to do what it is you love and are meant to do while you're on this planet.
Amen. Thank you.
Contane nga ci maki te ci satchu ndawi bayu maki ñi fi transhumer est ce que ñi ngi djel opposant ya ngi rebe festel maki ak wada dañu nuro.
That's Tony Blackman and Human talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Tony is a former hip-hop ambassador to the U.S. State Department. Human is a Senegalese journalist and hip-hop artist.
All's my life, hard times like, yeah, bad trips like, yeah, Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up, but if God got us, then we gon' be alright, right?
We gon' be alright. We gon' be alright. That line from Kendrick Lamar's hit song All Right has become the rallying cry, the anthem of the Black Lives Matter movement. It's also the title of journalist Jeff Chang's new book, a collection of essays on race, resegregation, and hip-hop. Chang has been exploring the intersection of hip-hop and politics for more than two decades. He's also produced hip-hop. He co-founded the indie label that launched the careers of DJ Shadow, Blackalicious, and Lyrics Born. Raymond Tungekar caught up with him recently to talk about hip-hop as a force for political change.
I saw you a couple weeks ago at the Wisconsin Book Festival, and there's one thing you said that kind of stuck with me. You mentioned that, you know, cultural change leads to political change. Has your thinking on that kind of changed at all since the election?
No, not necessarily. I think that the idea that, you know, a lot of us have been kind of thinking about and working on for many years is that we have to be able to expand the imagination for folks to kind of understand what kind of world we could actually create. And that's the work of people who are in the culture as opposed to folks who are working in politics. I mean, politics defines itself as the art of the possible, right? Art, in a sense, is about creating the idea of possibility, period. And so, yeah, we've been through this very divisive election cycle, and we're now in a period in which the country continues to feel extremely divided. And I think more than ever, it's important for those who are working in the culture to be able to offer visions of what it might look like to get past this sort of impasse, to imagine what a world could look like that's sustainable and inclusive and equitable for all.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, like, that kind of possible future or possible world imagined by artists could seem, you know, insufficient, right? Like, just some background. I'm Pakistani. I grew up Muslim. And that morning was, I just woke up in a daze, you know? It felt like there were large parts of the country who like, wanted me or, like, my family out, you know?
And absolutely.
To me, it sounds a little naive to think that, you know, artists can change that. I mean, not to be flip or anything.
No, not at all. And I welcome the question, because it can feel very ethereal or very distant or very sort of kumbaya-ish, right? Kind of suggest at this moment, right, when everybody is so divided and many of us, like yourself, very much feel in physical danger, right? Walking down the street, to suggest that there might even be another kind of way other than fighting back is sort of pie in the sky. It feels very distant. But I want to just suggest that if we don't have ideas to kind of carry us forward, we have a sort of situation, a present in which it's filled really with rage and nothing else. In order for us to get out of this box, we do have to kind of think about what it would mean to create an alternative. And so I wholly understand and support, you know, what you're talking about. The night of the elections, when it appeared that Trump was headed to victory, I posted something on Twitter that kind of went viral. And it was just recapping, you know, this old organizing saw, which is don't mourn, organize, right? Mm. And I paired that with don't despair, create. It went viral. There were a lot of people who wanted to kind of hear it at that particular moment. But at the same time, there were a ton of people, a lot of my good friends, who were like, wait a minute, I need to despair. I need to mourn. I need to really consider what this means for me and my family and my friends who are now like in the target sites of folks. And we've seen certainly in the past week all kinds of microaggressions, all kinds of hate crimes that have taken place, and at the same time, the denial of such, right? And so the backlash to the backlash is already in full swing. And in that kind of cycle of recrimination and of violence, whether it be verbal or physical, we've got to be able to think about how we get out of that. And that requires us to be able to focus on other visions. And I think that again, is the work of artists to be able to take us there at this particular moment.
Would you say, go so far as to say that they are on the vanguard of like political change?
I wouldn't say that. Okay. I'd say they're alongside a lot of other folks who are in the vanguard of political change. I'd just say that there's a place for them at the front line, and one that maybe we've kind of underestimated in our kind of maybe pure Cartesian focus on rationality. We need to be able to have visions. We need to be able to have stories. We need to be able to have songs that can take us up in the moments in which we're most down. I mean, look at Kendrick's song, right? It's called All Right. If you look at the title by itself, you'd think, well, this is a song that's just a happy, feel good. It's happy by Pharrell, right?
Yeah.
Because I'm happy. It's not that at all, right? It's a song that's really about struggle. And he's outlining for most of the song what it means to feel to be in a young black man's body at this particular moment in history, right? And all of the difficulty and struggle that comes with that. And yet out of the air, he seems to pull this lyric, you're effed up, I'm effed up, but if God's got us, then we're going to be all right. And that's why it's becoming an anthem. It's this dialectic of we're in struggle, and yet we're reaching for something bigger. And that's something that only art can do. It's certainly not something that I'm going to expect any politician to be doing over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we started this interview by talking about Kendrick Lamar's We Gonna Be All Right. Mm-hmm. You close the book by talking about another artist. You talk about Beyoncé's Lemonade. Which you seem to suggest offers wisdom on how we might move forward. Like, what could we, you know, glean from Lemonade?
Yeah, you know, I often say, well, I had to end with Beyonce. I start with Donald Trump, and I end with Beyonce because after Beyonce, there's really nothing left to say. But the album Lemonade was really striking to me, and it came out as I was trying to wrap up the book, actually. And it came out, and I was like, wait a minute, there's something going on here. The gossip pages kind of had it as, this is an album about Beyonce and Jay's marriage and how they almost broke up and what did Jay do to B and what did Bey do to Jay and all this other kind of stuff, right? But if you kind of look at it, I think that she was meaning for the album to be read against this backdrop of the rise of the movement for Black Lives. And in that sort of arc that she presents, right, of there's a betrayal, right, that happens, and then she goes through the different types of emotions that she needs to go through in order to try to recover herself, so to speak, right? She goes through anger, and she goes through pain, and then she goes through apathy and sort of disassociation. And then she tries to find her way back towards redemption and healing. And she does this by going home first, right? That's the sort of flipping point of the album, Daddy Lessons. And if you watch the video, because there was a video that accompanied it, there's a lot of images of sort of Yoruba kinds of practices. She's bringing in all these different types of images that are Afro-diasporic in nature. She's really going big in a way. And then there's this sort of breaking free, right? This is a song, Freedom, where she's now identifying her struggle with the larger struggle for liberation. And at the end, surprisingly, there's a reconciliation. She has a reconciliation with her lover. And the movie really touchingly ends with all of these images of Black couples, straight, gay, children, and this sense that we can all kind of come back together. And I said to myself, wow, she's actually making a statement here really about what justice could look like, what equity could look like, what whole futures could look like for Black lives that have been shattered by external and internal types of forces. And maybe this is a sort of allegory for us thinking about how society can mend itself. And so whenever I feel really, really down, I just put on Beyonce's album and I feel like, hey, maybe we really are going to be all right. I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flame.
Jeff Chang's book is called We Gonna Be All Right. Raymond Tungekar talked with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Writer Colson Whitehead is having a moment. His Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Underground Railroad, is airing as a 10-hour Amazon Prime series. The New York Times calls it the most widely anticipated TV series about slavery since Roots. Whitehead's novel is partly an alternative history. The Underground Railroad is reimagined as an actual train system, complete with locomotives and conductors. The characters include a girl named Cora, who grows up enslaved on a plantation in Georgia. Her friend Caesar urges her to escape, so Cora heads north, with slave catchers on her heels, looking for that underground railroad.
When Steve Paulson talked with Colson Whitehead, he asked him to begin by reading something.
The first time Caesar approached Cora about running north, she said no. This was her grandmother talking. Cora's grandmother had never seen the ocean before that bright afternoon in the port of Ouida, and the water dazzled after her time in the fort's dungeon. The dungeon stored them until the ships arrived. Dahomian raiders kidnapped the men first, then returned to her village the next moon for the women and children, marching them in chains to the sea two by two. The survivors from her village told her that when her father couldn't keep up the pace of the long march, the slavers stove in his head and left his body by the trail. Cora's grandmother was sold a few times on the trek to the fort, passed between slavers for cowrie shells and glass beads. It was hard to say how much they paid for her in Ouida, as she was part of a bulk purchase. 88 human souls for 60 crates of rum and gunpowder. Able-bodied men and childbearing women fetched more than juveniles. This was the ship's final port of call before they crossed the Atlantic. Two yellow-haired sailors rowed Ajari out to the ship, humming, white skin like bone.
So Cora, your main character, is a third-generation slave, and until she escapes when she's 15, she has never known any kind of life except that brutal life on the plantation that she's lived on. How would you describe her?
She's being described to me as a badass, so, which I find endearing. But yeah, you know, her mother, Mabel, has run away years before, and she exists on the plantation as a stray, someone with no family, and forced to fend for herself. You know, it takes a unique personality to contemplate being able to lead the plantation, a certain kind of bravery and strength that I'm not sure I would have had if I was in her place 150 years ago. So, you know, just being able to run from the plantation and aim herself north towards the moon, she's a formidable personality.
And so this becomes a story of how Cora starts to gain some control over her own life. I mean, some sense of agency when she's had none. But just as she's sort of developing this internal power, the forces all around her are closing in. I mean, of course, there is the racism of the 19th century, and especially the slave catchers who are chasing after her.
Sure. I mean, you know, I think a story of an escape from a plantation is already an adventure story. In this case, you know, I've come up with a different culture for every state that she moves through as she moves north. So North Carolina has a personality, South Carolina, Georgia.
What was the idea for that, that you sort of created these fictional cultures for each state?
Well, you know, I had the idea to explore what if the Underground Railroad was an actual railroad, that sort of childish idea you have before you figure out how things work. And that's a premise, not much of a story. So to complicate it, I followed the example of Gulliver's Travels, where each sort of state is a new island where we can see a different aspect of America explored. And, you know, I had this idea many years ago, and I came up with a white supremacist state, a black separatist state, a state where slaves are freed and given jobs and housing and education. And these different cultures allow me to critique different aspects of American history and talk about the changing concept of race in America.
So you've created your own alternative history. I mean, obviously, you're very familiar with the real history of 19th century slavery, but you're tweaking it all over the place. Is that so you can sort of play with ideas in a more creative way?
Sure. I mean, you know, my idea was I was not going to stick to the facts, but I would stick to the truth. And so what is slavery about? You know, I think once I made the decision to make a literal train, I was free from, you know, a certain burden of realism. And I could mix and match different episodes from American history to tell a different story than the one America sort of tells itself.
I would think writing about the slave experience would be awfully intimidating because, I mean, there has been so much written about slavery, so much good writing, I mean, both fiction and history. Did you sort of wonder, could you say anything new? I mean, figure out a way into this?
Well, you know, that's always a problem. Sometimes when I work on a book, I want to go see how other people approached it. Sometimes I don't. But this time, you know, I hadn't read Beloved by Toni Morrison in like 25 years or
The Known World by Edward Jones in 12 years. And so I was like, oh, I'll see how they do it. And so, of course, I read 30 pages of Beloved and was like, oh, I'm totally screwed. Like, you can't beat Toni Morrison, you know.
He's already done this.
So, but no matter what you're writing about, whether it's war or family or race, in all likelihood, someone smarter and more talented than you has done it before. So all you can do is trust that you have something new to say, something unique from your perspective.
So was it these elements of fantasy that you brought in? I mean, the counterfactual pieces of history and sort of playing with bits of more recent history that you incorporated into your story. Was that the way to make it fresh?
It's not the way I thought about it, but it was my first thought on how to elaborate on the premise of a literal railroad, and I stuck with it. I grew up as someone who didn't like to leave the house, and I always watched The Twilight Zone and Star Trek and read a lot of horror. And the people whose work I responded to when I first started reading were people who talked about the world through the filter of fantasy. You know, by tweaking, by adopting a different perspective, we can see the world in a different way. So for me, it seems like a natural tool of storytelling. Sometimes you want to be realistic, and sometimes, maybe coming at something sideways is the way to go.
There's one thing I have to ask you about. You have these great scenes in your alternative history. In South Carolina, after Cora's escape, she takes a job in a place called the Museum of Natural Wonders, where there's a section in the museum called Living History, and she's supposed to enact the life of a slave. Now, there's one exhibit called Scenes from Darkest Africa. Another one is called Life on the Slave Ship. And I mean, this is totally sanitized a view of history where slaves sew with spinning wheels on the ships coming over to America, of course, all on display for the white visitors to the museum. Where'd you get this idea?
A lot of the more absurd moments in the book are inspired by real life. And so at the great world's fairs in the 1800s, African Americans were put into so-called jungle garb and supposed to act like jungle natives for the audience, for people who would come and see. And that was this sort of fake representation of the Dark Continent.
It was like a zoo, basically, except for there were actual human beings there.
Yes, exactly. So, it sounds absurd, but that's how it actually happened. And as a writer, I'm trying to figure out ways for Cora to interact with history and how fake the white version of history is and how her own experience can actually provide a more true account of how the world works.
Well, I'd love to get a taste of this piece of your novel. And there's a moment where Cora finally decides to kind of fight back in her own way. Could you read that?
Certainly. One day she decided to retaliate against a red-haired white woman who scowled at the sight of Cora's duty on the ship. Cora didn't know the source of her animus or care. The woman irked her. Cora stared into her eyes, unwavering and fierce, until the woman broke, fairly running from the glass towards the agricultural section. From then on, Cora selected one patron per hour to evil eye. A young clerk ducking out from his office in the Griffin Building, a man of enterprise. A harried matron corralling an unruly clutch of children. One of the sour youths who liked to batter the glass and startle Cora. Sometimes this one, sometimes that one. She picked the weak links out of the crowd, the ones who broke under her gaze. The weak link. She liked the ring of it. The people she chose, young and old, from the rich part of town or the more modest streets, did not individually persecute Cora. As a community, they were shackles. If she kept at it, chipping away at the weak links wherever she found them, it might add up to something. She got good at her evil eye. They always broke, the people, not expecting this weird attack. It was a fine lesson, Cora thought, to learn that the slave, the African in your midst, is looking at you too.
Now, that is such a great passage. In my reading of this part of your book, and really sort of a through line throughout the whole book, is you're partly commenting on how the history of slavery has been sanitized throughout our own culture, in books and movies, because to truly show how violent, how dehumanizing it was, it's almost unbearable to see.
Well, I mean, who wants to think about it, white or black? I think if you are from the South and your great-great-great-grandfather had slaves, do you want to contemplate the tortures, brutality, rapes, and abuse that he perpetrated upon his property? If you were third-generation college African-American, your family has risen into the middle class, achieved the American dream, do you want to think about what happened 200 years ago? It is terrible to contemplate, and it's uncomfortable. And a lot of the work I'm trying to do in the book is try to make links between what happened 150 years ago and now.
What are some of those links that you see between 150 years ago and now?
You know, we could talk about the assault on the black body. 150 years ago, the police force in the South was the slave patroller, and a slave patroller would roam around plantations. They could enter any free black person's house and demand to see their papers. And if you were caught, you could be brought to jail, beaten. You know, the slave patroller had complete control over any black person they saw. They could stop them. And of course, the echo of that in policing now, you know, is not too hard to discern. I was taught at a young age that, you know, whenever I leave the house, I'm a target, and I can't rely on the police to protect me. I'm immediately viewed as a thug, a villain, and I can be stopped at any time. And, you know, of course, like a lot of people, I've been, you know, stopped in a car for driving while black. I've been handcuffed and interrogated. So, you know, that sort of casual abuse, which can often escalate into lethal abuse, is definitely part of my American experience. And so it's not too hard to find the linkages between the two.
That's Colson Whitehead, who won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Underground Railroad. He was talking with Steve Paulson. That's it for this hour, but there's always more in our podcast feed. Scroll down the list. You never know what you might find and what might catch your eye. To subscribe, look us up on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. And also, if you like this show, take a minute and give us a rating and a review. That helps other people find us. And yes, I know, everybody is always asking you to review things and rate things and like and subscribe. But we work hard on this show. We're proud of it, and we'd like to help other people find their way to us. And we need your help to do that. So thanks. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show, with help from Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.